Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, folks. I usually don't add a prologue to shows, but I need to do that today just due to the fact that this particular show, we were hit with a lot of interference. So you're going to need to make sure you read through these because a lot of what we read is lost or cut out because you won't hear it. So we've tried to do some editing to kind of clean this up so there's not a lot of dead airspace. But with that, that debt is fraud and it is now or never. And what's it going to take, folks? And as we're jumping into the South Carolina debates, we kind of just started them the past day or two. So we're going through what they considered red flags regarding the Constitution, their concerns, and don't be surprised that slavery was one of their primary concerns, as well as trade and so forth, because they were pretty dependent on their trade because they were producers and they needed to make sure that the agriculture that they were pulling out of the ground had a place to go. And so, being one of the bigger states, they kind of already had their own agreements and so forth, but South Carolina, being small, didn't have a corner on the market. In other words, they weren't the most desirable state in making trade agreements. That would have been Virginia. When many of the states, or I should say foreign nations, would have gone, oh yeah, we can almost get anything we want at Alice's restaurant. Now, I figured I would throw that little sub-reference out there because that really shows one's age. But anyway, they could practically get anything they wanted from Virginia. And so everything, folks, we're going through this so that you can understand how they describe why it was so necessary for this Constitution. They go through the species of money. They're going through their independent sovereignty, what they need, and you know, they're actually talking in South you know, Carolina and the slave states, the importance of maintaining slavery. That was a big concession, that they were going to be able to have their own self-determination of doing that. That they wouldn't lose that. Now, we've already seen in Massachusetts and Pennsylvania comments that kind of basically alluded to the fact that the way the Constitution has been designed, they saw the end of slavery by using the two-thirds, turning off slave trade, and so forth. That they saw the best potential in the Constitution of actually ending that dreaded, you know, trade and that dreaded business. So now we're going to see this, you know, the ever optimist of, you know, maintaining the status quo coming out of South Carolina and possibly North Carolina. I think North Carolina as well. With Virginia, they kind of see it more pragmatically. And so those who, you know, spoke out against this, you know, the inhibitions on slavery, because Virginia was a slave state, even though all of the delegates that went to the Constitution Convention wanted to get rid of slavery. And even though those delegates had slaves, they wanted to get rid of slavery. It's just that those other folks in this convention, in the ratification debates, they needed it. They weren't willing to give it up. They weren't willing to entertain, you know, using, you know, a labor force, hiring laborers, what have you, because labor was done by slavery. I mean, what nation in the world up to this point didn't use slavery of some kind to get the hard stuff done? China was doing it. Everybody was doing it. Slavery was like putting a belt in your pants to hold your trousers up. It was just something you did to help you function, and it made, you know, your I'll just say your environment more functional, you know, and, you know, more efficient. And believe it or not, right, wrong, or indifferent, It wasn't until the Declaration of Independence, which is just around the corner, we're going to be reading the original draft, like we always do. So we'll be doing that on the 3rd, just as a heads up. But as we look here at these states, you can see how they're looking at this Constitution from a different angle. All of them are. And this goes down to that old saying, that old wise saying, you see what you want to see and you hear what you want to hear. You know, people that have a predilection of taking advantage of other people always think that other people are taking advantage of them, because that's just how they see things. And so let's just go ahead and dive into this after I say one thing. It's all about constitutional compliance. We go through this so that you can learn and understand how important it is to hold public servants accountable to their oath of office and to that Constitution, to ensure that everything they do is supporting that Constitution. I'm going to remind you, Jerry Wistrand needs your help and support. I wish I had other candidates. I've actually talked with some, one or two in Washington State. Haven't got a pledge from them yet. Until I get a pledge, I'm not even going to mention names. You give me a pledge, and I'll start mentioning your names. That here we have a constitutional champion. And so it's easy for me to just say, oh, yeah, I support this guy, this guy, this guy. And most people would think, okay, well, there's got a lot of people going on there. Actually, what I'm really doing is I'm giving you the harsh reality that finding people willing to be held accountable at this point in time isn't the easiest thing to do. And if you realize how important it is for us to hold them accountable, then maybe you'll start appreciating those that we're getting, and maybe you might find, you know, the fortitude and, you know, whatever's necessary, the motivation to jump in to say, I want to be held accountable. That is the character of our public servants that we need to be seeking. I want to be held accountable. So with that, my friends, welcome back, Sean.
Good to be here, sir.
And so, any go backs, any comments, hey, I don't agree. Anything?
No, sir.
Okay.
I'm ready to go.
Okay, that's fine. Any elucidations on, you know, okay, that's fine. All right. Want to make sure that if there's an opportunity to clarify anything, we can. So, we left off at the Southern Carolina debate, South Carolina, Southern Carolina, and we were dealing with General Charles Coates Pinckney, and he was dealing with treaties. We already did two highlights of treaties. This is the third one. So let's go ahead and dive into this one. Thank you so much.
Now let us consider whether the power of making treaties is not as before the portion. It is vested in a president, state legislatures, each legislature choosing to. There is greater security in vesting this power as the present Constitution has vested it than in any other body. The president alone, if he would, his assertion that the power we have granted was as dangerous as the power vested by Parliament in the proclamations of Henry VIII might have been, perhaps warranted. Would he vested in a House of Representatives? Can secrecy be expected in 65 members? The idea is absurd. Besides, their sessions will probably last only 2 or 3 months in the year. Therefore, on that account, they would be a very unfit body for negotiation. Whereas the Senate, from the smallness of its numbers, from the equality of power which each state has in it, from the length of time for which its members are elected, from the long session they may have without any great inconveniency to themselves or constituents, joined with the president, who is the federal head of the United States, form together a body in whom can be best and most safely vested the diplomatic power of the Union.
Okay, so one of the things that I would have a disagreement with what you said, and folks, as you can tell, I'm hoping you read along with Sean, because we had some cutouts, some of the stuff we completely missed. But he points out towards the half section or a little bit later, he talks about would he vest it in the House of Representatives? Can secrecy be expected in 65 members? The idea is absurd. Besides, their sessions will probably last only 2 or 3 months in the year. Therefore, on that account, they would be a very unfit body for negotiation, whereas the Senate, from the smallness of numbers and the inequality of power which each state has in it, from the length of time from which its members are elected, from the long sessions they may have without any great inconveniency to themselves or constituents, joined with the president, who is the federal head of the United States, form together a body in whom can be best and most safely vested the diplomatic power of the union. Now, he's repeating what was stated in the convention, but my problem with the argument, and I haven't said this ever before, is the number of people being entrusted with information is not the problem. Never has been, never will be. The character of the people being entrusted with secret information is the problem. Because if you do not vet these people, and if you do not hold them accountable, in other words, you use loose lips, you let this slip, and we will hang you. Now we're talking about holding people accountable. Now the secret is safe. How many people today have clearances with, I mean, very, very sensitive information? It's not just a handful, folks. It's not just a handful. Hundreds of thousands. I'll say that again. Hundreds of thousands of people with very sensitive information. I'm not talking about just secret. I'm talking about, you know, super secret, top secret, you know, what they call, there's a special word for it. It's compartmentalized. It is, I'll just put it to that. It is compartmentalized, where it's well above even top secret. There's hundreds of thousands of people with those types of clearances. Hundreds of thousands. And so, I mean, do we have, you know, dealings where somebody slips? Yeah, we got spies like, you know, Snowden. Snowden was not a hero. If Snowden really wanted to do America the favor and point out what was going on, he wouldn't have taken it to foreign nationals. He would have actually taken it to the states, state legislatures, and said, hey, look, this is what the government's doing to your citizens. You need to step up. That would have been the appropriate place, period. This guy did everything he could to aggrandize himself, and he got his 15 minutes of fame. As far as I'm concerned, I would be happy to see this man hang. Happy to. He's not my hero. People died because of him, and he damaged, you know, the apparatus and processes and measures of what we use, as well as people, and so forth. I mean, he did so much damage by just handing this stuff over. Anyway, oh, well, we deserve it. Yeah, I guess that's what the communists would say. But anyway, I digress. Let's go back to the debates, and let's look at the next one with Rogue Island.
Ask the citizens of Massachusetts if the Confederation protected them during the insurrection of Shays. Ask the crews of our vessels captured by the Algerians if respect for our government had softened the rigors of their captivity. Inquire of our delegates to Congress if all the dispatches from your public ministers are not filled with lamentations of the imbecility of Congress, and whether foreign nations do not declare they can have no confidence in our government because it has not power to enforce obedience to treaties. Go through each state in the Union and be convinced that a disregard for law had taken place of order, and that Congress is so slighted by all of them that not one hath complied with her requisitions. Every state in the Union, except Rhode Island, was so thoroughly convinced that our government was inadequate to us all. General Pinckney said it had been alleged that when there, they exceeded their powers. He thought not, apprehended, but they did not think. The present Constitution is but a proposition which the people may reject. But he conjured them to reflect seriously before they did reject it, as he did not think our state would obtain better terms by another convention, and the anarchy which would in all probability be the consequence of rejecting his Constitution would encourage some daring despot to seize upon the government and effectually deprive us of our liberties.
Okay, so let me get you to stop right there. And unfortunately, we're still getting some cutouts. I don't know if the internet is being stressed because somebody's lit themselves on fire because they, you know, want petitions and a full accountability. I don't know. But let me read the one part that's highlighted that kind of got missed a little bit. They had a right, he apprehended, to propose anything which they imagined would strengthen the Union. He's talking about the convention in Philadelphia. He's emphasizing they had a right, he apprehended, to propose anything which they imagined would strengthen the Union and be for the advantage of our country. But they did not pretend to a right to determine finally upon anything. The present Constitution is but a proposition which the people may reject. But he conjured them to reflect seriously before they did reject it, as he did not think our state would obtain better terms by another convention. In other words, he's basically saying there was a huge compromise that gave us an advantage with our slavery. You better think twice before you consider saying we should go for another convention. Yeah, this one didn't do it. So I think he's laying it out there because the sentiments were changing. And as a matter of fact, I think if it's not already been mentioned, it will be mentioned in this debate and probably the North Carolina debate if it hasn't been already mentioned in this debate. That the sentiments of the North are quickly changing. They're giving up and they're freeing their slaves. They are moving hard into abolitionist movement. And he said, if we think coming to the meeting again in 5-10 years is going to be better for us, think again. He's laying it down on the line. And this actually goes to help refute this idea of this runaway convention that these imbeciles want to try to regurgitate today, those concepts of the anti-federalists back then. The anti-federalists were using that as a leverage to kill the Constitution. What are the imbeciles doing today to try to use this same argument? Are they doing the same thing, trying to kill it? Because they're not trying to help it. Does that make sense, Sean?
Yes, sir, it does.
Okay, let's go ahead and continue on.
Every member who attended the convention was, from the beginning, sensible of the necessity of giving greater powers to the federal government. This was the very purpose for which they were convened. The delegations of Jersey and Delaware were, at first, averse to this organization, but they afterwards acquiesced in it. And the conduct of their delegates has been so very agreeable to the people of these states that they respect the Constitution. As we have found it necessary to give very persons in the states a right to draw one branch of the legislature immediately from the people, and that both wealth and numbers should be considered in the representation.
Okay, so you kind of broke up again, but that's all right. That's all right. Folks, again,
What do you mean I broke up?
Well, so the audio is dropping because of the connection. It's like it's not a latency issue. It gets garbled and that type of thing. It's not bad.
It's
but
doing the same thing when you're speaking.
So okay. So in other words, okay, so you're experiencing it from me as well then. So it's not me. It's not you. It's probably free conference call because I've got the bandwidth on this end, and I know you do, so there's something that's hitting free conference call or something that's hitting the internet, right? it is what it is. But let me get back to the one point you put out here that's not highlighted that I think is important. He points out, because, again, the assertion is that the first Constitutional Convention was a runaway convention. We've talked about this before. By definition, a runaway convention means that the people abandoned their responsibilities and they just ran away from what they were supposed to do. What he says here is, he says, every member who attended the convention was, from the very beginning, sensible of the necessity of giving greater powers to the federal government. This was the purpose for which they were convened. In other words, they were there doing what they were supposed to be doing. That doesn't seem to me like they abandoned and ran away from what they were supposed to do. It's just a convenient fear-mongering tactic that is being used as a method in getting people to take a side over an Article 5 convention right now. In other words, convening a Constitutional Convention today. When all you need to say is the purpose of a Constitutional Convention is to fix a problem with the Constitution. The fact is, the Constitution is not the problem. The conversations of having a Constitutional Convention today is more driven by lobbyists who want to amass money and try to have fun at our expense, as well as even dabble in making changes that would actually make our federal government either more powerful or more inept. And I don't think it's inept. I think what they're going to do is they're going to actually give it bad powers. So, folks, it's been on my mind to share with you the Idaho, because Idaho, everybody looks at Idaho, it is a dark red state. I mean, they take a lot of heat because they're so conservative. And it's been on my mind because I got a copy of their platform. It's kind of long. But I need to go through this so I can actually spend the day or two going through their platform to show you what a threat their platform is, an absolute threat to the Constitution. This is what happens when people become so conservative that they lose sight of the Constitution. And this happens to be, you know, a place where the John Birch Society is just, they're not saying anything about the party platform. I mean, this is one of their biggest, you know, I'll say membership areas. They've got a lot of members in there, in the party and so forth. I think that out of the states with the John Birchers, you'd probably say Utah, Idaho, Montana. Those are probably the top three states of membership. Utah being the number one. But I'd even go through the Utah Republican Party platform. Folks, when you start reading these things, you go, oh my gosh. In the Idaho one, just off the top of my head, I know that they want to have a balanced budget amendment to allocate or to basically put a spending cap on, you know, what the federal government can spend based on the GDP. Instead of based on the enumerated powers. Hey, the Constitution already has a spending cap. You can only spend money on these objects. If you're spending money on anything that's not enumerated, then that is fraud and you're violating the Constitution. But yet they want to aggrandize and say, well, we're going to allow you to continue to spend all this money as long as it doesn't exceed an amount. You see my point?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So, what do we want? Do we want to allow ourselves to... We're going into break, obviously. I didn't even see that coming. So the question is, do we want to continue being led by the blind, or do we want to actually start seeing to help these good people who are blind, you know, see their way so that we can stay away from these huge pits and these abysses and canyons that we're going to fall into? We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so before we kind of move forward, any comments on my babbling? None? Hearing none? We'll move forward. Okay, so, and actually, Sean may be actually speaking, it's just that he might actually, you know, be disconnected at this point in time. Who knows? No, he was muted, I guess. Anywho, so now Mr. General Coatsworth Pinckney is going to go through slavery. But before he does, and the nice thing about how this was kind of labeled is we put the label way up on top of the paragraph, so you kind of had to scroll down to find the highlighted part. Because previous, you know, in many of the other sections, and what I'm doing now is I'm kind of moving these marks down to that part of the paragraph so it's easier to find, because I know you feel like you're on an Easter egg hunt, Sean, when you're trying to find the comments with this debate?
I'm pretty used to scrolling by now.
Oh, okay. So, actually, at the very underneath what you just read, there is an account of citizens and blacks and so forth that they kind of account for. You don't have it highlighted, but I just highlighted it in blue. And this is where they actually talk about what they believe the expectations of representatives are going to be based on these numbers, because at this point in time, they don't have a census. And a census specifically for this. So in other words, they may have had censuses before, but it wasn't really important where everybody wanted to know the accuracy. Moving forward, the census of the United States, accuracy was everything. And all of the states had interest in making sure that they were accurately counted for so that they could get the proper representation that they deserved. So this is why this was kind of included in here. And you can notice that when they mention all of these northern states, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Delaware, even though some of those states may have had some slaves, for the most part, they're not even listing them because they see the trend that they're actually releasing and getting rid of slavery in those states. So the only states that were remaining with slavery is Maryland, who rubber-stamped the Constitution, Georgia, who rubber-stamped the Constitution, and so the only three states that actually vigorously debated the Constitution being Virginia, North Carolina, and South Carolina. And Virginia, they had 280,000 slaves. South Carolina, even though it was more sparse, less populated than North Carolina, South Carolina had more slaves total, more slaves in total. So that kind of goes to thinking, well, okay, so I can see why they are very focused on the slavery issue, because it's almost a one-for-one, or it's almost half the population if you look at the numbers, the way they're accounting for it. So as we go down a little bit further and we hit the slavery part, let's go ahead and pick that up right there.
The general then said, He would make a few observations on the objections which the gentleman had thrown out on the restrictions that might be laid on the African trade after the year 1808. On this point, your delegates had to contend with the religious and political prejudices of the Eastern and Middle States, and with the interested and inconsistent opinion of Virginia, who was warmly opposed to our importing more slaves. I am of the same opinion now as I was 2 years ago, when I used the expressions the gentleman has quoted, that while there remained 1 acre of swampland uncleared of South Carolina, I would raise my voice against restricting the importation of Negroes. I am as thoroughly convinced as that gentleman is that the nature of our climate and the flat, swampy situation of our country obliges us to cultivate our lands with Negroes, and that without them, South Carolina would soon be a desert waste.
Okay, so I think of Sam Kennison in thinking of your circumstances. If you're really dependent on something else, and especially something as repugnant as slavery, then you need to figure out what else you can do there or just move. You know, because Sam Kennison, if anybody's ever seen it, I think it's either Somalia, Yemen, or some, you know, Middle Eastern country that has, they can't grow their own food. They're completely dependent on, you know, external food and external everything. That they, I don't even think they have much oil. They're just destitute. And he goes, why are these people living there? You know, well, instead of feeding them, why don't we just help them and move them and let them live somewhere where they can survive on their own? Now,
I saw a report just the other day.
Go ahead. Yeah.
That talked about how the whole paradigm of what you're talking about, just like with Sam Kennison, I think I remember seeing that, but they actually exacerbate the problem because they come in and they give aid and they provide everything to sustain these people in the situation they're in, and that causes them to increase in population. So now what you're doing is actually increasing the number of people that are going to be facing starvation and can't sustain themselves.
Right.
It's ridiculous.
Correct. What it does is it amplifies dependency, increasing more people to become dependent. Because...
But to also create more people that will be dependent.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
So
yeah.
the population rises, right, because they're providing the sustenance for them to continue multiplying,
right,
and creating a greater population.
Correct.
That's at risk.
And then as soon as sentiments change to say, you know what, we're not helping these people anymore, then it becomes even worse. I mean, then there's this, you know, a skid mark on history of the nation that turns its back after, you know, being so generous before. As I look at this type of behavior, it's enabling absolutely bad behavior. The real question is, by this point in time, everybody on the earth has kind of claimed, or I should say, people have created governments that have claimed, you know, their own tribe, this is our land. The problem is that those divisions were created because of tribal division, that type of thing. So in other words, the likelihood, you would think that we wouldn't have to cart wheat. You wouldn't think that we would have to cart, you know, all this food and assistance across the world to these types of nations, that their neighboring nations that might be better off would just bring them in. But no, they were divided because they didn't get along. Does that make sense? And so it's there's this concept of how do you get to that point where, you know, you can actually say, you know, we can start migrating people to do that. Well, technically, there are nations that do allow migration. And the United States is one of them, constitutionally. The problem is, we're not doing that. And so, because what we're doing, and this actually becomes a real problem too, because we import that problem. If we were operating migration the way we're supposed to migrate, in other words, if a person wanted to come to the United States, the state, you'd have to determine what state you'd want to move to. And that state would dictate to you that, you know, if you got these bad religious practices, don't bring them here. As a matter of fact, until the late 1800s, every state in the Union banned Islam. Every state. We don't want you here. And so when the states actually said, okay, we're going to start doing this, we're going to start allowing this, that was a big part of the changes that the progressives brought with them, because they knew that those would be devices or tools that would start shifting and changing the landscape of America to get us to become more tolerant and allow literally our enemies to live with us. The real problem is that if people wanted to immigrate and they wanted to come in, they would absolutely have to, on their own, abjure their allegiance. But if they had these religious ties, then they couldn't go anywhere. So what this does is, by allowing things to go their full course, if a group of people are, you know, believing in a particular religion, and they're not willing to put that religion down, then they need to find a place, i.e. Saudi Arabia, that are a place with their like faith or like religion, and basically go to that place where they can still practice that religion. If there's no place on the face of the earth for them to do that, then they have to either, you know, wait it out or change themselves. It's one thing to say, well, we'll let you go if you come in to say you're going to do this, but we know how it is. We know that they're going to lie, they'll be deceitful, and they will come in and claim that they're, you know, going to change their faith, and next thing, voila, now they don't have to. They're going to claim religious freedom, what have you. So the point I'm trying to bring up is that we have enough empirical data to understand these problems. We don't have to allow these problems to be played by, you know, by these, I'll call them juveniles, because that's exactly what they're doing. It's like they're standing there saying, oh, well, we're going to, you know, we're going to be good. You know, you won't even notice us. And behind their backs, their hands are crossed, or their fingers are crossed, right? So they come in and they do what they do. So bottom line, you have to let history, or you have to let people run its, or I should say, change has to take its full course. And until they change on their own, they're going to continue to take advantage of those who have that, I'll just say, you know, that tolerance, that acceptance, and so forth. So
that suicidal empathy.
Yeah, okay, there we go. But folks, if this kind of goes down to the story in the Old Testament, I think is it Isaiah with Baal, and you know, and challenging whose God is great, where, you know, I'll have my God come and take up my sacrifice, and you have your God, and you go first. And then they try to get Baal to come and take up their offering, and nothing happens. Then Isaiah, I believe it was Isaiah, right, that actually went out there and had God, you know, take up and
Elijah.
What's that?
Elijah.
Elijah, thank you. And so anyway, and then he said, you know what? I'll have my God take up your sacrifice too. And to prove to them that, you know, his God was the real God. Now, if these people, you know, really believe that they're doing, you know, their God and he had all powerful and all of that, then their circumstances will change. And it won't have to change at the expense of other people. You got to remember that God, at that point in time in the Bible, could have done, you know, the other Old Testament thing and had him war and go and kill or do those types of things. But these were very specific points in time to actually prove, you know, who actually had who was truly God. So my point is this, is, you know, let them go through and let them, you know, on their own, realize whether their God is truly God or if it is a creation of manipulation that has been used by the tools of men in trying to, you know, basically pervert and subvert governments and religions. Because right now, the empirical data, to me, proves that Islam has been a tool that has been used by manipulative men to subvert and pervert both the religions and governments of men. Am I wrong?
You are not wrong, sir. And that is a documented fact.
So, I mean, ask the Persians.
Even in their scripture,
yeah,
that is exactly what they are commanded to do.
So,
and all the tolerance in the world is not going to stop them, because that's the whole thing. Okay, our God says that we're supposed to take over the world and force everyone to worship the way we do from our scripture. And we say, oh, well, come on in. You got religious freedom here. It's like, did you not hear what they said?
Yeah, right. Yeah, so ask the Persians how well their reformation or the restoration of the Zoroastrian faith is going. Because the Persians, being Iran, used to have the Zoroastrian faith as their faith. And now that they became Islam or Islamist a long, long time ago, there has been a movement within Persia to restore its Zoroastrian faith. And that ain't going to happen as long as Islam is in control. So anyway, let's move on, because actually this is kind of apropos, because, and I'm bringing this up because South Carolina is actually one of the few states that talks about the Mohammedans. So let's go ahead and bring up the next point on slavery. Go ahead.
You have so frequently heard my sentiments on this subject that I need not now repeat them. It was alleged by some of the members who opposed an unlimited importation that slaves increased the weakness of any state who admitted them, that they were a dangerous species of property, which an invading enemy could easily turn against ourselves and the neighboring states, and that, as we were allowed a representation for them in the House of Representatives, our influence in government would be increased in proportion as we were less able to defend ourselves. Quote, show some period, said the members from the eastern states, quote, when it may be in our power to put a stop, if we please, to the importation of this weakness, and we will endeavor, for your convenience, to restrain the religious and political prejudices of our people on this subject, end quote. The middle states in Virginia made us no such proposition. They were for an immediate and total prohibition. We endeavored to obviate the objections that were made in the best manner we could, and assign reasons for our insisting on the importation, which there is no occasion to repeat, as they must occur to every gentleman in the House. A committee of the states was appointed in order to accommodate this matter, and after a great deal of difficulty, it was settled on the footing recited in the Constitution.
Okay, so right here, he's giving you a great snapshot of who was willing to make a compromise and who wasn't. And who wasn't willing to make the compromise? Virginia and the middle states, the northern states. Well, okay, you know, if you can show us that, you know, what the point is, and then we'll allow it. See the difference?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. All right, let's keep going. Thank you.
I had a question mm-hmm. about the just staunch facts of the statement that he made at the beginning, that the importation that slaves increased the weakness of any state who admitted them. They were dangerous species of property, which an invading enemy could easily turn against them and neighboring states. I mean, how did we avoid that point of argument?
They couldn't.
In the issue.
They couldn't. Remember, during the convention, they said, yeah, you're right. That's why you need our money to help fight the war, so that we can defend ourselves. They were a liability. That's why I've said it. This was a huge bad decision. You know, if America made a bad business decision, it was allowing those three states to leverage in maintaining the slave trade and not creating the end play of ending slavery in America by allowing it to die on its own. But instead, they decided to create the political compromise. And so it was one of the worst political compromises ever made in America. Because look at today. I mean, we talk about the enemies among us. There are people today that, because of misinformation and because of, you know, I'll just say it, this indoctrination of, you know, hating people because of their color. The misinformation regarding our framers and how this nation was framed. There's no doubt in my mind that black people in America, if they were actually taught the truth and if they actually read these documents, they would look at this situation a lot differently. The fact of the matter is...
A lot of people do. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
There are a lot of people nowadays, and you can hear their voices more and more, that are on the same page with what you're talking about. But personally, I think it's a biblical judgment. And if think about how things would have been different if the Constitution would have ended slavery. And those people that were in slavery were allowed to become citizens at the time of the Constitution, how much different things would be today than they are.
We would not have the problem we have today.
Correct.
We may have other problems. It's not that we would be problem-free.
No.
But we would not have the problem we have today. So I see it this way. I see it that as things move forward, it didn't mean that there weren't going to be oppressive jerks. It wouldn't mean that there would be people that would collude together and actually redefine the Constitution, redefine the amendments, the 14th Amendment specifically, to allow Jim Crow laws. The 14th Amendment did not allow Jim Crow laws. It had to be redefined by the court to say, well, we see it this way, so you can do that. But that was a direct defiance of how the 14th Amendment was defined. You can't tell me otherwise. Equal protection
under the
law.
Same thing with the birthright citizenship nowadays in this era of the mass migration.
Correct. And so, folks, this goes back to who is the culprit behind all of this? It is the courts. The courts have been instrumental in undermining the Constitution and its meaning by trying to redefine it, by trying to interpret it so that it could become a tool in their agenda in moving America in the direction that they want to move it, towards globalism, towards communism, so forth. So, anyway.
And they're using, the Marxists actually use these abominations that we, you know, that occurred in history. Mm-hmm. As part of their agenda to destroy it, to destroy our constitutional government and our liberty.
Sure.
Because they pit factions against each other on the basis of our past evils.
All right.
You know, the oppressor and oppressed class, the whole thing, you know, it pretty much bolstered their whole indoctrination program.
All right. So let's read the last paragraph of this part, highlighted part. Thanks.
By this settlement, we have secured an unlimited importation of Negroes for 20 years, nor is it declared that the importation shall be then stopped. It may be continued. We have a security that the general government can never emancipate them, for no such authority is granted. And it is admitted on all hands that the general government has no powers but what are expressly granted by the Constitution, and that all rights not expressed were reserved by the several states. We have obtained a right to recover our slaves in whatever part of America they may take refuge, which is a right we had not before. In short, considering all circumstances, we have made the best terms for the security of this species of property it was in our power to make. We would have made better if we could, but on the whole, I do not think them bad. It's amazing to me how, just like with the, we were talking about yesterday with the 11th Amendment,
mm-hmm.
they jumped up and wanted that passed to say, yeah, the states have sovereign immunity. And like here, oh, we have the power. They can't tell us what to do.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and the things that, that benefit the people at large and individual liberty, oh, they got a problem with it. But when it comes to securing their property and their finances, then they are all about state sovereignty.
Right. So when we look at what we're reading, we're actually, if you remember the convention, how these men talk back and forth, they're clearly speaking a little more frankly. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
In other words, you can see what's in their hearts. More so because I think there's a level of shame when you're up there talking to people that are basically what you're talking about is absolutely repugnant. How could you even be a human kind of thing? I mean, that was the contrast between slavery or and abolition and the delegates there. So again, they had to put aside their differences. And but these men of the South, like Charles Coatsworth Pinckney, I think at one point in time, he says, I agree with you that we need to get rid of this. But then he stands up in this debate and says, I will, like anybody else, stand as long as we have swamp land, we need slaves. Right? I mean, so the way he deliberately changed his tone and sentiments only speaks to the fact that he's the consummate politician, saying what he needs to say so that, and I think that this is more of the honesty of him than during the convention, kind of like in Alexander Hamilton. He had to soft pedal in the convention so that he would try to maintain some pull and or some influence, because what ends up happening, because if I remember correctly, Butler was kind of a hard nose, and Butler wasn't getting anywhere with changing people's minds. So sometimes you have to be a little more diplomatic in saying, you know, I completely understand what you're saying, and I see it that way too, to get them to come along and give you a compromise. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely.
And so, folks, I'm just showing you what you can garner by reading those conventions and reading what these men said and how they said it and then reading what they say in these debates. And you can see, oh, okay, so he was not fully honest in those convention comments and or what he was saying. Or he had a motivation or an intent to do something different. But let's go on. Go ahead and read this from Mr. Barnwell.
I didn't know Dave Ramsey was that old.
Yeah.
All right, I'm scrolling. No, down.
No,
maybe
no. Dr. David Ramsey.
Yeah, you have. Okay, Mr. Barnwell continued.
Uh-huh. Go ahead.
Mr. Barnwell continued to say, I now come to the last point for consideration. I mean the clause relative to the Negroes. And here I am particularly pleased with the Constitution. It has not left this matter of so much importance to us open to immediate investigation.
So my bad. My bad. So what ended up happening was we were both kind of looking at the document, and we completely ran out of time. So we're going to pick this up in our next episode, folks. And I'll even comment on the Jim Clymer along with the Dave Ramsey. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description
of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.